We'll just continue. Just to sort of recap, we started talking about data centers, cloud computing. I introduced what are data centers. They're large server farms, as I showed you pictures here. So facilities that have racks of large numbers of racks of servers and storage. They typically run server application, internet application, web application, online banking, any online application that you think of, it's actually running in a data center, one or more somewhere that is run by that organization. As I mentioned, data centers not only consists of computational and storage capacity, servers and storage, they also have a lot of equipment to do cooling. There's networking equipment, there are backup generators, UPSs and whatnot. So it's expensive to build and operate data center. Okay, but that's really what keeps most of these online applications up and running. Okay, so then I mentioned virtualization as a concept that is actually used in most of these data centers. The definition of virtualization is basically it's an interface that mimics, that runs on a new platform and mimics a different interface. Okay, that's really the broad definition. I talked about how it came about from the mainframe days when companies like IBM came up with new hardware, new operating systems, but there was a need to keep old code or old applications running on this new hardware. So they essentially wrote this layer called a virtualization layer that emulated the older hardware and old operating systems. And that technology is now used in a variety of different contexts, not just for portability. I mentioned different forms of virtualization, from application level virtualization, which includes Java Virtual Machine, Rosetta technology in Macs, Wine emulator on Linux and Macs, etc. There's application level virtualization, you can have OS level virtualization, and you can have hardware virtualization. The virtualization that we have really been talking about is hardware level, where you can run one or more operating systems inside virtual machine on a server. Okay, so that is basically, we talked about two types of virtualization. One runs on bare metal, the other one runs on a host operating system. This one is basically server-based virtualization. The other one is typically used in desktop environment for doing development and things like that. Okay, so in most data centers, you basically have virtualization layer. That's really the kernel that's running on most of the servers. You construct one or more virtual machines. You run operating systems inside those virtual machines. So a given server can run more than one virtual machine or virtual server. Okay, and each of those virtual machines can run arbitrary applications. Okay, so this is typically how data centers are set up. We talked about a whole set of challenges. I didn't tell you how these are addressed, but there are these challenges that you have to address, which include how do you manage resources efficiently, how do you deal with applications whose workloads go up or down, how do you handle with applications that get overloaded over time. You must have experienced some website or the other where you go to it and it says server overloaded, I cannot accept it. If you get slash dotted, or you have a what's called a flash crowd, typical news story breaks and then many newspaper websites go down because they get overloaded. Okay. If the applications are well designed, this shouldn't be happening. They should have enough capacity, or they should be able to dynamically increase their capacity to deal with workloads. Now the big challenge in data centers is there are hundreds of thousands of servers in many large data centers. They may be running tens of thousands of applications or more. Okay, so managing this large facilities is very complex. Okay, so there's a lot of automation that is built into these data centers. Lots of things can happen automatically. You can bring up a machine, you can reboot, automatically reboot servers, you can move machines, virtual machines from one server to another, allocate more capacity. A lot of these tasks, which typically in normal environment a human administrator has to do, is typically automated just to allow you to manage these large complex facilities. Okay, so that's one side of the picture. The other side is energy efficiency that we were talking about. Most of these data centers consume a lot of energy, a lot of power. So In fact, many times the location of the data center is chosen so that you can optimize your electricity bills. Okay, so Google, for instance, puts its data centers near the Columbia River because there's a lot of cheap hydropower available there. Okay, the power bill for these data centers can run into millions of dollars a month. Okay, so if you can reduce the cost of electricity by 20-30%, that's real money that you're saving there. Okay, so energy is a big issue for most of these data centers. Okay, so how do you optimize the energy consumption of a server or these data centers themselves? Big issue. Okay, there are data centers that are beginning to use renewable energy. Okay, so as a picture that I meant to bring, but I forgot. Apple has said that most of their data centers will run off solar power very soon. Okay, they actually bought 200 acres of land to just put solar arrays. It generates several tens of megawatts of power that powers their data center. Okay? Now, that's good because then you get energy or electricity for almost free, but then when you make design data centers that run off renewable sources, you have other problem, okay? Because renewable energy generation fluctuates over time. You don't get solar energy in the night, for instance. You can't power down your data center in the night, clearly. Okay, there will be still servers running. So, yeah, and then even from day to day, there may be fluctuation. If it's a sunny day or a cloudy day, the amount of solar that you're going to power that you'll generate will fluctuate over time. Okay, so you try to make the system green, but then you have a whole other set of problems where the energy supply will fluctuate over time. Okay, how do you deal with those issues? So, all of these make data center designs incredibly complex and also interesting. Okay, so some of these topics that I mentioned, they are still active areas of research. Okay, it's not all the questions have been answered. There are some reasonable ways to design data centers today. Okay, so I ended with this pie chart, which I'm going to just show again. This just shows you typical costs of building and operating a data center over time. Okay, so the blue, think of it as servers and other infrastructure. The green is basically power and cooling. Okay, so this includes cost of air conditioners, cost of electricity to run those air conditioners. The only takeaway here is, if you can see, the cost of energy is a significant part of building the total data centers, and not a small piece. This includes the cost of equipment, the cooling equipment, and the operational cost of running it. Okay, this is why I was saying optimizing energy is a big issue in many of these data centers. Okay, so there are, of course, economies of scale. The larger these data centers, the cheaper it is to cheaper per unit cost it is to build them, because you get economies of scale. Okay, very large providers like Google, they don't even go buy servers; they design their own. Because if you need 100,000 servers, it's actually cheaper to go design your own server and get it built to your specs than go and buy something from the market. Okay, so as with anything, they even design their own switches for that matter. So as with anything, the larger you make these facilities, you get economies of scale, but also, as you can imagine, it becomes more complex to manage this very large distributed system. Okay, 100,000 nodes, networking, storage, all of these resources have to be managed. Okay, already said, lot of automation used. Okay, so lots of things are done automatically, so humans don't have to go and press buttons or do things manually. Okay, and the general trend is still towards larger and larger data centers. Okay, so as I said, 100,000 server data centers are now becoming common. Okay. Now, all of these trends have also led to the popularity of cloud computing. Okay, that's really the topic we are going to discuss today. This was mostly a recap. Okay, so we'll start with what is cloud computing, what are the types of cloud platforms out there, what do these do, okay, what kinds of advantages you get from cloud computing, and so on. Okay, so you probably have heard of the term cloud computing already. Okay, it's become a big buzzword. So if you ask two different people what does cloud mean, they'll give you two different answers. Because to different people, it means slightly different things. Okay? So there are various ways to define it. I'm going to pick one definition, and we'll see how well that works for us. So very broadly, what cloud computing is, it's a way to rent resources, not necessarily buy them, okay? And pay for resources as you use them and have them be managed by someone else. So what does that mean? So let's suppose you want to set up a website. So you have two choices. You can buy a server, connect it to a network and run the website on that server. That's the traditional way of doing things. Or you can rent a server. And it's somebody else's server. They just allow you to rent it. And then you run your application or website on that server. In the latter case, basically, with some additional enhancements, has become what is called cloud computing. Okay? It has always been possible to make these two choices, rent or buy. And you do pick one of these two options whenever you want to get computing infrastructure. The choice is you have to rent or you have to buy. But what cloud has enabled you to do is basically it has added some automation, so renting is very easy. You don't have to go and show up at someone's door and say, I want to rent a machine. You pretty much set up an account and request a machine and you get it in a few minutes. Okay, so a lot of automation built in. Okay, so very broadly, cloud computing essentially is a technology that allows you to lease remote resources, rent remote resources and pay for them based on usage. Okay, and we'll talk about what all of that means. There are many, many different cloud providers here. They seem to be grayed out for some reason. So, a few features here. First of all, it's service. The resources are remote. Okay, some sitting in a data center somewhere. The second big advantage of cloud platform, it has pay-as-you-go model. Okay, you don't pay upfront. You basically get billed at the end of each month based on how much you have used. Okay, just as your phone company may say, you use so many minutes of calls and charge you based on that. The same kind of thing is true here. Okay? So you can get, you can pay in a very fine-grained manner. Okay? So some servers you can rent by the hour. If you just rent it for an hour, you only pay for the hour. Okay? You don't have to pay for anything longer than that. Okay? So pay as you go. It has high scalability, which basically means that these are large data centers, so you can get lots and lots of servers very quickly. Okay. And it is a shared infrastructure, which means there are other users also sharing that cloud platform or that data center with you. Okay. This cloud platform has many different customers. So those are the features, and I'll make some of these concrete as we go along. Okay. So there are different types of cloud platforms. Okay. So if you think about the various applications that you may already know about, they are, many of them are cloud services and they actually fall into several different categories. Okay, so the three main types of cloud platforms that are out there are what are called infrastructure as a service, or IaaS clouds, platform as a service, PaaS clouds, and SaaS cloud, software as a service cloud. Okay. So what these, how they differ is basically what are you renting and what do you have to provide by, on your own. So at the very bottom here, what is called infrastructure as a service, you get to rent raw servers or disks, storage. Okay? Everything else you do. Okay? I mean, you rent a server, then you can put whatever OS you want, you can run whatever applications you want in there. Okay? All that the cloud provider is renting you are servers and storage. Okay? That's called infrastructure as a service. So as a raw infrastructure, you can do whatever you want with it. Okay? If your platform as a service cloud, you are actually renting a platform. What that means is you rent not only servers but also some software that runs on top of it. Okay? And then you can run applications on top of that platform. Okay? If you heard of Google App Engine, okay, or Microsoft Azure, I think the E is missing here. It's not Azure, it's Azure. So those are platform as a service clouds. Okay? Azure, for instance, allows you to design .NET applications and deploy them. Whether the cloud provides all the runtime, the OS, the hardware, all of that that's needed to run those applications. Same with Google App Engine. You can write Python apps and then you deploy them. And all the infrastructure needed to run that, all of that comes to you as a part of your renting this cloud provider, cloud platform. Okay? The very top is the software as a service cloud. Okay, so here you basically get the hardware, software and applications. Yeah, so the best way to describe it is like Google Apps, Google Docs. These are all examples of cloud services that are SaaS services. Okay. So here you will get an application. In this case, it's a mail application or word processing or whatever it is that you have in Google Docs, the OS that these applications run on, and the hardware. Okay? So you get it all as part of this offering. Okay, so here these are hosted applications. So Salesforce, if you heard of Salesforce, is another example of business apps that are provided using a cloud service. Okay. So as you go from infrastructure clouds to software clouds, you will see that the cloud provider is doing more and more, okay, in terms of what it provides you. Here you get bare bones hardware. Here you get hardware plus OS plus some platform that runs your application. Here you get the application, the platform, and the hardware. Okay. So you get more and more from the provider. That means you have to do less. But also there are less controls on what you can do. Okay, there's only, you can't say much in terms of when you sign up for a Gmail account, you sign up for an account. You don't say run my Gmail server on a quad core machine. You don't get to say that. Okay, the cloud provider decides where, which machine they run it on, what they do with it, etc. Yes, question.
So like, for instance, with like software service, like, are you paying more because they're offering you more?
Okay, so the question is, what are you paying? Okay, so there is a billing model that's associated with all of these, which I did not describe at all. Clearly, the billing model will also change based on what kind of platform it is. Okay, so in this case, you pay by the server or you pay by gigabyte of storage. Okay, in that case, you may actually, it doesn't make sense to say where you pay by the server. So in the case of mail, for instance, you pay by user and user accounts. Okay, so Gmail charging model is $25 a month per user. Okay, and then they give you some amount of storage, 25 gig or whatever it is. Okay, so iCloud, same example. Okay, if you actually rent storage, that kind of model. Yes.
Those are bidding models too.
Yes. So I will talk a little bit about that when we go to Amazon in the next slide. Okay. So there are many different ways to pay. Okay, that's just a couple that I mentioned. Doesn't necessarily mean you pay more, okay? But as you can imagine, the more the cloud provider does, they have higher costs. So somehow they have to run at a profit. If they're running at a loss, they won't be in business anymore. So implicitly, they are paying. You are paying a little more, okay? But there's no explicit. The models cannot even be compared. Here you are renting servers. There you may be renting mail accounts by user. Okay, they're not directly comparable. Yeah, but the costs that the cloud provider incurs do go up as they do more and you do less. So somehow they have to recover those costs. So that is reflected in how they bill for these services. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the first two in more detail. I'll not talk about software as a service clouds much. Okay. So infrastructure as a service cloud, many examples here. Okay, Rackspace, Amazon, many, many different providers. Even Microsoft Azure, you can rent servers now, Windows servers and Linux servers. Okay. So as you have probably seen when you been working on your term paper, probably know a little bit of this. So what you can do in Amazon, for instance, is they give you different types of server instances. Okay. They give them names like small, medium, there's large and extra large with high CPU. So there are these labels. Yes, each label stands for a server of a certain configuration. Okay, so here is a, so if you go and say, I want to rent a small server, you get what is called one virtual CPU, okay, about 600 megabytes of RAM, some amount of disk space, which I forget what it is, and you pay about 2 or 3 cents an hour for renting that machine. Okay. Not a whole lot, pennies an hour. Okay, but you get sort of fairly low-end machine. Okay. And then if you say that's not good enough, you can say I want a medium-sized instance, you will get 4 or 5 cores. Okay, they're not real cores, they're virtual cores. Okay, you get more RAM, get more disks, and so on. Okay, so you can decide based on your needs, your application's needs, what size server to rent. Okay, and the rates will go up as you rent bigger server. So you can see some of the largest server cost like $2-3 an hour. Okay? The smallest ones cost 2 cents an hour. So big difference. It's not that this one is giving you 100 times more capacity necessarily, okay? But it is much bigger and it costs them more to rent those out. Okay, so there are different instances that you can rent. Okay? Now this is just what is called an hourly pay-as-you-go pricing model. Okay, there are many different ways to pay for it as well. You can pay upfront annual costs. Yeah, and then you can rent at a discounted price. Yeah, so you pay saying, I'm likely to rent, so here is an upfront charge. And then when I rent a machine, they'll give you a discount. Yeah, that's a different pricing model. As was pointed out, you can also bid for servers. Okay, price line model. You know what price line did at one point. Okay, you could go and bid for an airline ticket. So I want to fly to California, I only want to pay $50. Okay, they'll say yes or no. You bid too low, you say, I cannot give you an airline ticket. If you bid enough, you can say, here's a ticket. Same is true here. Okay, you can say, 2 cents an hour, that seems awfully expensive. I can give you half a cent. Will you rent me a server? Okay, and you put in that bid, and it may be that you are put in a bid at a period where they don't have enough customers. Okay, and then they say, rather than letting my servers idle, I have to pay for electricity for the server. Here, take it for 2 cents or half a cent or whatever you bid. Okay? The only caveat is if you go for a bidding model, they reserve the right to take the server away from you. If the price of servers rises and there's more demand, they'll take the server back. Okay? In this case, so long as you're willing to pay 2 cents an hour, you get to keep the server. Okay? Whenever you do bidding, which is called spot instances can be given to you when the price is appropriate and they can be taken away from you at 5 minute notice. So you may be running a job, they'll say too bad, in 5 minutes the server is going to be shut down, I'm going to give it to a customer who is not as cheap. Okay, and then they'll actually take it away from you. Okay? Now you can look at the historical prices and say what price should I bid so I get to keep the server for a little longer and all of that. But they always reserve the right to take it away. Yes.
Yeah, that's exactly what my question is.
Yeah. So they do give you history, so you can check what is the right price and so on. But spot instance, so they don't recommend that you run your mission critical website on a spot instance. Okay, because it can go, if they take away the server, your application ain't running anymore. Okay, so you better run that on a reserved in what these are called reserved instances that they guarantee will actually keep running. Yes.
What's the bidding model when you're outbid? Your running instance like migrated somewhere and
it's state
held or is it just dumped out of the system?
So they put all this burden on you. They say you will get a notice, 5 minute warning saying your machine is going to be taken away. You have to figure out if you get this warning, what is it that you need to do? You need to save some files, you need to move it over. They will give you that much time to do it all. And then the machine goes away. Then they are not responsible
for
it. Yes, so there are many ways to design that, right? So people have to make use of this low-end, not low-end, but low, really low-cost server computation. So what people do is they run them on disks that don't go away and the server goes away. Okay, there are what are called persistent disks and temporary disks. So most of these machines come with temporary disks. As soon as the server is taken away or you shut down your machine, the disk is wiped clean, all the data is gone. You can also pay more and get a persistent disk called EBS, Elastic Block Service. Okay? Those disks don't go away. Those disks are not attached to any machine. Okay? Those are network storage. So you can actually run it on a spot instance on EBS volume. So even though the machine goes away, the data is still there. Later on, you can go back and see what happened and so on. Your process may disappear. Yes.
Great application like Hadoop workers where they can spawn and leave,
yes.
Work and die.
So if you are basically spot instances work best for batch application, of which MapReduce, Hadoop are one. Batch applications one which are not time critical, they may take long. So you say I want to really do this on the cheap. I don't take care whether it takes 6 days or 20 days. Okay, I'll just run it every hour night, maybe it runs for 4 hours because that's the only time the price is that low. It may take long but eventually it will end. But you need a way by which you can save intermediate state. Okay, saying I did so much computation, here is where I left off. And then next time you pick up, you load that and you compute and so on. Okay, so you can't run arbitrary things on these kinds of spot instances. Okay, because it's hard to actually get any useful work if your machine keeps being taken away from you. Yes, only certain kinds of jobs will run when you do these kinds of computation. Okay, so there's also the other thing I should mention is there's extra charge for storage and bandwidth. Yeah, bandwidth is charged based on number of requests you make, the amount of data transfers and so on. Yeah, so you get a bill based on your total computational storage and network usage every month. Yeah, that's basically how Amazon is going to bill for you. Okay. The interesting thing here is you can basically essentially construct a server at a push of a button. Okay, basically you have to show up with a credit card. You need an Amazon account. Show up with a credit card and you can say, give me a server. And you specify which type, in a few minutes your server is up. And you can, by default, you can pick a standard distribution they provide, or you can provide your own distribution and they load that for you. Okay, in a matter of minutes, it will be ready. You can log in and actually do whatever you want to do on it. Okay? So it's really on demand. As you can imagine, there's no human sitting in the loop. When you say, give me a machine, an administrator goes and says, let's put it on that rack. Okay, all of that's completely automated. It's a large data center, all automated. Okay, you basically make a request, request goes in, automated scheduler says, where are the idle servers here, let's pick that one. It constructs a virtual machine, it loads your image, and then it sends you a signal saying, done, your machine is up and running. Okay? Even billing is automated. There's no person sitting there saying, this guy used 3 hours and that guy used 2.5 hours. So there's a lot of automation built in. Okay? You can shut down your machine at any time. You can say, small isn't good enough, now give me an extra large, or I need 5 medium ones. You can send in your request, you get those machines. Okay? So all of this is actually happening automatically. So this is, as you can imagine, cloud platforms run on data center. The other interesting thing that large cloud providers do is they also allow you to pick a location where your server is based. Okay? They provide, in case of Amazon, they call EC2, they call them availability regions. Okay? These are regions where they have data centers. So they have one in Virginia, one in California, one in Washington on the West Coast. There are data centers in Europe, Asia. So when you say, I want a server, you can specify where you want your server. You want it on the East Coast, West Coast, Europe, Ireland, Australia, you can pick Japan, you can specify. Okay, and they will actually allocate your virtual machine in that region. Okay? So if you are deploying your application, you have to think, if your internet application, you have to think, where are your end users? And you put your virtual machine in a region that is close to your end users. Okay? So that way they get better performance. Okay? You can also, if you have a very popular application, replicate across data center. You can say, I'm going to run one instance of my website or whatever it is in California, one in Europe, and one in Asia. Okay, and then whenever users come in, I send them off to the closest location so they get the best performance. Okay, so large applications essentially do this kinds of optimization. Okay. Now, this is just the server part of what Amazon does. Okay, Amazon, actually, if you look at Amazon, a mind-boggling number of services, 20, 30 different services. You can rent databases, you can rent map reduce instances, you can do all sorts of different things. All that I mentioned here is just the infrastructure as a service part of what Amazon does. They provide caching services, they provide you services to deploy things. If you have large software downloads and things like that, they have service for that. Lots of different things have come out from this very basic building block that they have provided. Okay. Any questions on IaaS clouds? Okay. So the next one we'll talk about is platform as a service cloud, or what are called PaaS clouds. Okay. The example we'll use here is Google App Engine. Okay. So here you get not only a server, but you get an OS and some platform. In this case, it's a Python-based web platform that runs on top. Okay? So from your standpoint, and customers of the cloud standpoint, you just bring your application, in this case Python code, okay, and you deploy. And then it runs on their platform. So you don't have to actually, if you are doing this on Amazon, you would actually rent a server. You would load your own OS. You would then install Python or whatever else you want. Okay, then you prepare all of this, then you deploy your application. So you do a lot more work before your application is ready to run. Here you can essentially deploy application code, because the rest of what is called the hardware and software stack is provided to you by the cloud provider. Okay. Now, there is an API in this case of Google App Engine that you have to use in order to run on that platform. You can't run some arbitrary Python script. Okay, in this case, you have to basically write it to their API, but so long as you do that, it will run. Okay? Microsoft does the same thing. Okay, you can actually take .NET applications, okay, and then run it on their Azure platform. You can even deploy it through Visual Studio. They have a way to take Visual Studio and then deploy application directly on their cloud. It'll run there. Now the interesting thing that PaaS cloud do, which IaaS cloud don't do, is they will automatically figure out how much capacity to give to your application. You don't have to say, give me a small server. I'm going to write this blog that millions of users are going to see, so I need a really large server. You don't say any of that. You just say, I'm going to deploy my application, and they'll figure out based on how many requests are coming, where to run it, whether to replicate it. You don't do any of that. Okay, they'll say, this application is really popular. We'll run it internally on 6 different servers so that it has enough capacity to service all of the requests. All you get at the end of the month is a bill. It says so many requests are serviced, and if you have a popular application, you pay higher charge. Okay? But they do all of the complexity for you. So if you did this on Amazon, you would have to decide, first of all, which type server to pick, if you need to do more than one, which type, and how to replicate it, all of that, you as the application provider have to figure out and configure and so on. Okay? So the burden in this case is on you, because you are renting low-level hardware. You run it on a platform as a service cloud, the burden is on the cloud provider. They have given you basically what is called a SLA, or a service level agreement, which basically the requests come in, they get serviced by so much time. Yeah, you can say, I want a 1 second SLA. 1 second SLA says anytime a request comes in, you basically have to service it within 1 second from the time it entered your system. So that means basically if more requests come in, they have to deploy more and more capacity so requests are not sitting there waiting for service. Okay. So you basically have a contract. This contract is referred to as an SLA with the cloud provider. Okay. Contract can be depending on how much you are willing to pay, you can get whatever contract you want. But there are some standard ones. And most of them basically say that you don't have to worry about what machine, how many requests. They will figure all of that for you. Okay. So one thing to keep in mind is platform as a service cloud are not necessarily based on virtualization. Okay, internally, they might use virtualization, but they don't have to. Okay, so these many of them will, because there is internally it makes it easier to manage, but that's not a requirement. You just need to provide a platform to deploy your customer's code. So in case of Google, some of these engines are not actually based on virtualization. You basically have internally lots of threads. As requests come in, you basically start handing them off to threads so you can scale them up or down. Okay? You can even hand them off to threads of different machines. Okay? So the way they have configured it is every server is pre-populated with lots and lots of threads that are just sitting there. Okay? And there is a dispatcher, which is a module that takes requests for your applications and just hands them off to threads saying, go service this request. Okay. And then basically these threads are shared by multiple applications. And different applications can share this code. Okay. So you do less, but you also have less control, okay, in this case. Because the cloud provider is doing more stuff. You don't have control over what kind of machine it's running on, quad core, single core, half a gig of RAM, 10 gig of RAM. None of that you have control over. In Amazon, you have complete control. You can rent the type of server and so on. But you have to do more there. Okay, so you can see this trade-off. Okay. I won't talk about software as a service cloud, but the same progression will continue. Okay. In that case, even the code is already there. You are basically our entire applications that are hosted for you. Okay, so you don't even have to write the application. And you will get even less control. Okay, you don't get to say where it runs, how it runs, all of that. Okay. You still have to pay for it, okay, unless you are signing up for free Gmail account, but there is versions of Gmail that are paid and so on. Okay, so you do pay for those services in many cases, and but you have to do even less in terms of managing. Okay, so that's basically the types of clouds. Infrastructure clouds, platform clouds, software clouds. Yes, question.
So in the infrastructure as a service cloud, what is the thin client displaying exactly? Is it a video file?
Which thin client are you talking about?
When you're interacting with this infrastructure as a service cloud, you have a thin client that's displaying to you what's happening in the cloud. What's actually on that thin client? Video or?
Okay. Alright, so you are asking a very specific question. Let me first explain how infrastructure as a service cloud works, and then we'll come to your question. So tip, at this very basic infrastructure, the service cloud is just a server. Okay? This server, you can run whatever you want. Okay? You can access it remotely in one of many different ways. You can just SSH into it. Okay? This is what you will all be doing for your lab. You don't have a thin client. You are giving your server that's running on Amazon. You are accessing it remotely using SSH. Okay? No thin client. You're just using a terminal. You SSH, you copy your code, you run it, and so on and so forth. Okay? Here you can also, this server, you can run whatever you want. You can run VNC, you can run Windows with RDP, Remote Desktop Protocol, and so on. If you do that, then you can have a graphical thin client that is actually connected to it. And then you can manage this server graphically. Okay? So that's the question you are asking. So in this case, that's a different way of interacting with it. So you can basically use Windows RDP or in Unix your VNC or any of these thin client protocols to connect to it. So you are asking, what is this running, right? So this is running a special protocol that allows you to take the console of this server or whatever, the screen or the monitor, and display it remotely. Okay? That's not a video application. That's a very specific application that is designed and optimized for displaying screens. Okay? It's not video. What it basically does is every time the screen is refreshed on the server side, it is actually doing difference. Say, what was the previous screen and what was the next screen? Only parts of the screen that change, you send it over here. Okay? And then you only basically update those pixels. So let's say you basically take an icon and you drag it here. Okay, so only these pixels are changed. This icon has been dragged here. So it will only take those pixels and say only this part of the screen has changed, and you send it. The reason for this optimization is the network here is basically a slow link. So you want to reduce the communication over it. You could send the same screen over and over again, but that would be less optimal. Okay? If you did video on the other end, real video, you would actually send the entire screen every time. Okay, that would be much more bandwidth intensive. So these applications are tuned especially to operate over lower bandwidth links. At one point you could do this over dial-up modems, that is, okay, which is very slow. Okay? Any other questions on infrastructure? No, but that, just to be clear, that's not normally the only way to connect to the servers. You can do SSH, many other ways to interact with it. Okay, infrastructure clouds, we did platform clouds. Any other questions here? Okay, so we will talk now about a slightly different model. These are called, different dimension. Okay, so these are called public or private cloud. Okay, so whatever I talked about, Amazon, Google, Microsoft, Azure, all of these fall under the rubric of what are called public clouds. Okay, public clouds essentially means anybody can sign up to get service on those clouds. Okay, anybody who is willing to pay for those services. Okay, and so now there are many companies that run their own internal clouds that are not open to outsiders, but only open to employees or people that work inside that company. Those are called private clouds. Okay, now as far as the functionality goes, they do the same thing as public clouds, except that these clouds are not exposed to the internet. They are typically used inside an organization. Okay, let's say UMass tomorrow buys a set of machines and makes them available to anybody who is a UMass faculty or student. Okay, that would be called an internal private cloud within UMass. Okay, there are open, just as you can get Linux as an open source software, there are many cloud sort of tools that you can get and just run it on these machines and construct your own cloud. Right? There's one popular one called OpenStack. Right? That's an example. So you can just download OpenStack, run it on Linux, and it gives you a lot of functionality that Amazon does. Okay? You can just come in and say, give me a machine. The OpenStack software has automation built in. It is managing a cluster. It will figure out, here's the idle server. It will construct the VM. All of that, what is actually Amazon does, this kind of piece of software will do for you. Okay? There are many such commercial ones also. But so basically, you can set up your own private cloud, okay, for your organization, for yourself, but something that's not open to outsiders. Okay? So as you can imagine, many companies, they run their own internal clouds for their employees, to run their internal applications, and so on and so forth. So those are called private clouds. For public clouds are ones that organization like Google and Amazon and Microsoft run for anybody who is willing to come in and sign up for the service. Okay, so that's basically a private cloud. Now internally, as for how to manage, both of these run on data centers, whether it's public or private. Both of them have to do a lot of automation. Both of them use virtualization. Okay? So they are basically the same as far as the technologies goes. One is available to anybody who is willing to pay. The other one is closed for the public. Okay? Only used for private. Okay? So that's public or private cloud. Okay? Now there is a different, another model called hybrid cloud that combines the two. Okay, and so why would you actually want to take a public cloud and private cloud and try to combine? Sort of get resources from both to run your application. Okay, so let me give you some examples. So let's say you run your private cloud, okay, your company, let's say your UMass. Okay, you are running your own private cloud. It runs on, let's say, 50 machines. Okay, let's suppose it's end of the semester. Everybody is doing their course project. Everybody is going and said, give me my own machine because I want my own machine to test my project or whatever. So lots of students do that, and you soon run out of space on your private cloud. Because, I mean, there's only so many virtual machines you can run on a 50 server cluster. Okay. Now what do you do if you need more capacity? Okay, you basically do that. You buy more servers. Okay. So you will go and order a server, but it will take 2 weeks at least for your server to show up, because you order it, it comes, and then you install it, and so on and so forth. If you need capacity in the next hour, not in the next month, okay, you don't have much choice. Okay, the only thing you can do is you can basically go to a public cloud and say, my private cloud is filled up, I'm going to get some of your machines and add them to my cloud pool. Okay, if you do this, you have what is called a hybrid cloud. That whenever possible, you will use your private cloud. Whenever your private cloud gets overloaded, you will overflow into a public cloud. Okay? This is referred to as a hybrid cloud. It's the sort of the newest technology that people are getting excited about. So you build your private cloud, and whenever you run out of cycles or whatever, you overflow. Okay? Whenever you have a load spike, you are going to. So this way, you don't have to have these extra machines that get used one day of the month or the 1 month of the semester when everybody wants to machine. All the other time they are sitting there idle doing nothing because there isn't enough demand. Right? So this is a good way to build your infrastructure. Okay, so now this is sort of a more general principle which says when you deploy any application, okay, you have to think about how much capacity you want to deploy for that application. Okay, let's suppose it's a website. Okay, you want to deploy a new website on a machine. How do you decide whether you put it on a small machine or a medium machine or an extra large machine? How will you decide that? Any thoughts? So let's make it any application. Doesn't matter whether it's a website or an application. Let's say you are IT person in the company. Okay, so you are, somebody says, here is an application, go deploy it. Okay, which means put it on a server and get it up and running. Okay, how do you make a choice how large a server to pick? Yes.
You can baseline it to start based on previous experience, but you can start it as small as possible and then grow it if you're using cloud.
Yeah, so let's assume it's not cloud for run. Just saying, how would you do? So you need some, yes?
I was going to say you could profile it.
Okay. So you need some way to figure out what kind of load or request it is going to see. Okay? And then you make some guesses based on, is this going to see lots of requests, very little requests, and based on that you make an estimate on, should I put it on a small machine, should I put it on a big machine with lots of RAM. This is how you normally, this is called provisioning. Okay? This is sort of there's a science to it. I'm just describing the crude way. You need to have some estimate of the load that you are expected to do. It's not guaranteed, but it's an estimate. And based on that estimate, you're going to pick. Right? Now, in most cases, you will make the choice based on what you expect is the worst case or the maximum load you are expected to see. Because if you pick it based on an average load, if your load goes above average, your application is going to be in trouble. Okay, it's going to get overloaded and not be able to service the request. Okay. So the point I was making, the reason we sort of detoured here, the point is whenever you deploy any application, you have to have an estimate of the maximum load it needs to service, and you provision sufficient capacity. You put it on a machine that's big enough. Okay. Now in doing so, the problem is in the most cases, you don't see the worst case load. You see something that's close to an average load. That's what average means. Right? So you are mostly underutilized as a result. Okay, you provisioned for a lot more because in some day the worst case load may come, but on most of the time you are running way below. Okay? So a lot of unused capacity sitting there getting wasted. Okay? Whether this is your application or whether you are building a cluster, the problem is the same. You have to size it, you have to provision, and you always provision based on worst case. Okay? Now the reason I mentioned all this is if you have a hybrid model, you can actually save a little bit of money. You don't say how large should my cluster be, and that's based on what happens in the last week of the semester when everybody wants. Typically that's how you do it. What will happen in the worst case? Spire is they have provisioned it based on what happens during registration time, where everybody is going into register. You take an average week of the semester, the load on Spire is negligible. No, hardly anybody using it. If they took that as an average and only gave it a machine of that size, when it comes registration time, your Spire will buckle. It has buckled, in fact. It buckled to a point where it was not operational for several weeks. Yes.
So, like, for instance, like when Spire has these like really huge loads at the end of the semester or whatever, like why wouldn't they just run it for like that week?
Yes, so that's exactly where I'm going. So one way to deploy applications, you say this is the worst case, I buy enough capacity to service the worst case, but I am basically going to waste lot of capacity when I don't see the worst case. Okay? Another way to deploy your application is you look at the average case and you basically get a machine that's big enough to get in a good service most of the time, and only when you actually get the worst case, you get additional capacity from the cloud. Okay? I say, so that 1 week of that semester, I'm going to rent those 10 servers from Amazon. Okay? I only pay for that 1 week. I don't have this server sitting here idle for the remaining 4.5 months of the semester. Okay? I can actually reduce my cost by doing that because I don't have to buy these 10 additional servers and have them sit there idle. Okay? This is why this kind of model is actually very useful, where you say the public cloud allows me to rent on demand, pay by the hour. So I'm going to exploit that to the maximum. I'm going to only rent for that 1 week or the whatever 1 day of the month where I need it. And then I just give that server up. I only pay for what I need. Okay? So these kinds of optimizations allow you to cut costs. Okay, if you're an IT administrator, you'll actually, or have any knowledge of what IT administrators do, you'll understand what I'm saying. You don't have to have all these extra machines, extra disks that are sitting there idle. So you basically buy less and rent whenever you overflow or get overloaded. Okay, yes.
Okay, this is like a business question. But do clouds outsource to other clouds?
Do clouds outsource to other clouds? Good question. Hasn't happened. Private clouds outsource to public cloud. That's a hybrid cloud. Okay? I don't know of any instance where a public cloud outsources to another public cloud.
Like UMass is building their own cloud warehouse, right?
Yeah.
Presumably, they'll be outsourcing that cloud to other users in order to, make money.
Oh, you're saying, do you make the cloud available? By outsource, I may have thought you said one cloud actually offload to another.
That's what I mean. And then if the load scales beyond the capacity of the UMass server, they can outsource their incoming load to another cloud.
Yes. So that is
a cheaper price than they might charge.
That is basically what some hybrid clouds actually do. But it's not public to public. You take your internal cloud and you overflow into an external cloud. Yes, your question or comment?
Just to sort of answer his question, fun fact, iCloud is actually a combination of Amazon AWS and Microsoft's Azure.
Yes. So there are many cloud services that run on other cloud services. Netflix runs on Amazon, surprisingly. But that basically says that you built a software as a service cloud using another infrastructure as a service cloud, right? Practically every big, like Twitter, runs on other clouds and so on. But you built one thing using something else. Okay? You are asking a separate question saying, I have a set of servers, can I use my own infrastructure and overflow into another infrastructure? This is far more common. you take Amazon servers and you build a service, and then you make that a cloud service. Dropbox presumably runs on a bunch of other cloud infrastructure. That's a software as a service cloud that runs on somebody else's servers. That is very common. But doing this, which is taking some servers and overflowing, that's less common. That is the model I was mentioning here, which is this hybrid model. Okay? So let me now just conclude. So a few things I will not go into too much detail, but when you talk about running cloud applications, you have to design your applications in many different ways. You can use the standard client-server model, okay, something that you are doing in your lab. There are many batch applications that run. Okay, they run once in a while, so there are batch jobs that can run on cloud. They are built differently because you have distributed infrastructure. And then there are these new programming models like MapReduce or Hadoop. Okay? They allow you to process lots and lots of data in a highly parallel fashion. Okay? Lots of machines that read a lot of data in parallel, do computation, use a very specific model called MapReduce to essentially process all of the data. Okay? These kinds of models have emerged as a result of clouds becoming more popular. Okay, so you can run these MapReduce batch jobs on. So this forms this basically more data-intensive programming model. Okay, different models have emerged. There are, as I said, platform clouds that have their own programming models or APIs you program against them, okay, and so on. Okay, last slide, and then we are going to end for course evaluation. Many challenges to address. Biggest one that comes up all the time, still unresolved, is privacy and security. Okay? I put my data on somebody else's machine. How do I know that it is secure? Okay? This is by far the single most biggest questions that companies deal with. Okay? The reason they are still very reluctant to use public clouds is they have no control. Somebody else's machine, somebody else's storage. What if somebody breaks in? Is their security good enough? What if my data is sort of breached because there was a break-in into Amazon? Okay? No good answers for these questions. Okay? So when it's somebody else's thing, you have to take it with a grain of salt. Okay? Does Google read your email? Do you want to trust Google? Some people don't. Okay? They don't like that Google actually looks at your email and shows you an ad based on what the text of your email says. Okay? They don't want that. They think my email is private. You shouldn't read it. Okay? So there's a trust involved here. Like what can I trust the cloud provider to do for me? Is that enough for me to trust you to give you my data and or application? Okay? How can you make it secure? Okay? Single biggest unresolved issue. Yes.
Are these same people also against spam
filters? Are the same people? Well, let's not go there. I will just give you an example of what happens when you run your trust somebody else's with your data and or application. Okay. So major issue, unresolved issue. There are many others. Extreme scalability. Okay. It's a very interesting problem of how do you efficiently manage 100,000 servers without having 500 people at each data center doing all sorts of management tasks. Okay. How do you automate these tasks? Okay. In none of the things we have talked about in this class did we talk about automation at all. Okay. But that's critical to most of these very large systems, whether it's a data center, cloud, or any other distributed system. The system grows larger. To make it more manageable, you have to employ some form of automation. Things have to happen automatically, without a human in the loop. Okay? Another big problem, okay? Important problem. Programming model is yet another. How do you write parallel distributed applications that keep scaling? Okay? As your application becomes more popular, more users come in, will it scale? Okay, there's an interesting article on Facebook, how it kept changing its internal architecture, that it grew from thousands of users to millions of users to hundreds of millions of users. Because the same design decisions don't work. They don't scale. You'll start seeing bottlenecks in the system. Okay, so writing some application to serve millions of users is very different from writing an application to serve 50 users. Okay? So you have to design or architect the application differently. Okay, that's not necessarily a cloud challenge, but it especially becomes common in the cloud where you put something up and it suddenly becomes popular, but it's not designed to scale, so it buckles up under the load. Okay, so lots of interesting issues that you have to resolve. Now, many of these are open challenges. In some cases, people have made some headway. We cannot look into all of that here, but there are other courses that do go into some of this in more detail. Okay, so with that, I am going to end the lecture. And we will take a little break here. Don't go. I need a volunteer to administer the course evaluations. Anybody wants to do it?
Yeah.